So a Mormon religion scholar and an atheist, and this sounds like the setup to a joke, but let me finish. A Mormon religion scholar and an atheist have started a podcast to explore what is really in the Bible. Not what believers or non-believers think is in the Bible, not what they tell their congregations or their TikTok followers, but what is actually in all of those pages. The scholar in this duo, Dan McClellan, has an impressive academic resume and a social media following where he acts like a kind of buzzkill for apocalyptic conspiracy theorists or overly exuberant skeptics. In the podcast, he and the atheist in the mix, another Dan, Dan Beecher, try and strip away the biases that people bring to the Bible and just look at the data. And that's what we'll talk about today in Radio West after this.
KUER is available via radio through a network of transmitters and translators across Utah. We are also available to you beyond the dial. Stream us on your computer, put us in your pocket with the KUER mobile app, subscribe to our podcasts, and listen to us at home on your smart speaker. Use our station finder for your nearest signal and explore more ways to stay connected to NPR Utah at KUER.org/listen.
Dan McClellan has an incredibly popular social media presence. His TikTok following alone is something like 400,000 followers. He's not making sandwiches or raising chickens or dressing up his cat. He's a religion scholar with 4 degrees, one from Oxford. And what he does is debunk claims about the Bible. He calls out misconceptions and conspiracy theories. McClellan has a new podcast. He's teamed up with a man named Dan Beecher, who also has a social media presence. Beecher is an outspoken atheist, a former Latter-day Saint. McClellan is a current Latter-day Saint, describes himself as a faithful Latter-day Saint. He graduated from BYU. For years, he worked as a scripture translation supervisor for the church. So you've got atheist, you've got believer, but the podcast isn't a debate. The idea came from what they were both seeing online. There are a lot of videos about the Bible out there, and McClellan says a lot of it is just wrong.
So some of the material that originally jumped out at me was a lot of stuff about new discoveries about artifacts and things like that that people thought were supporting certain positions on the Bible, on religion, on Christianity, on Islam, on whatever. One of the ones was what they called the Jordan Lead Codices, a set of 70 lead books that were bound together that were discovered in Jordan.
This is a find that could change the way ancient Christianity is studied and maybe even how we perceive Jesus Christ himself.
Looked into this and started sharing a lot of data that indicated pretty strongly that these were forgeries, that they were fake.
As well as the earliest mentions of Jesus Christ.
So not a word of this is true because the text...
So I made a video in response to that, and then I was like, I wonder what else is out there. There's got to be a lot more people sharing stuff.
I see a lot of, like, the worst of what's on offer on the internet.
Well, I'm a religious zealot, and, you know, I love the Bible. I love God's word. I believe that the law of the Lord is perfect.
Like, very hateful pastors using the Bible as their bludgeon against marginalized people.
You know, Leviticus 20:13 clearly says, if a man also lie with mankind as he lieth with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination.
A lot of what I see out there is people saying, I know what the Bible says. I'm correct about the Bible.
You know how people say that the Bible's not real, that it's made up? Well, I'm fixing to show you something that proves that it's real.
And then we get a lot of doomsday stuff.
In the book of Revelations, it talks about the Euphrates River drying up and releasing the four fallen angels that are bound underneath the Euphrates River.
A lot of end times prophecies. That is a very big business. And I've started to notice that there's like a script going around.
In the book of Revelation in the Bible, it talks about the great Euphrates River in the Middle East. And it says that in the...
Yes, I know the Euphrates dries up often or almost every year, but never like this. Not to where it exposed something deep below it, something like a cave.
God chained up some of the angels and put them underneath the Euphrates River in the Middle East.
Four fallen angels that are bound underneath the Euphrates River.
You have a dozen different creators who have 200,000, a million followers on YouTube or on Instagram or on TikTok saying literally word for word the exact same stuff and using AI-generated art to kind of paint a picture for the people who are watching. And it has to do with the Euphrates drying up. It has to do with China or Russia, trains derailing. The Book of Enoch, there's a lot about the Book of Enoch and how our DNA was altered by aliens who came to the earth. And, you know, this is all in the background of the Book of Genesis. These are ways for people to feel that their beliefs or their suspicions about the world are all validated.
And this is why, you know, gay people shouldn't be allowed to blah, blah, blah. And this is why we should be ignoring trans people and throwing away our Bud Light cans because there's a trans person on it. And this is why, because I already know. And let me tell you what the Bible is. And whatever you believe, you're going to find the passages to support you.
Either everything's a big conspiracy or everything's a prophecy that it's about to come to pass. So a lot of it has to do with saying my side is right about this.
I understand the plight of a parishioner who doesn't really get what's going on in the Bible, because when I read the Bible, I'm baffled a lot of the time.
There is misinformation on all sides. It does not seem like there are a lot of voices out there calling balls and strikes, saying, let's just look at the data. And that's what made me want to get into it in the first place. And I think that's what has made people gravitate towards that approach.
Really, in the end, what does the thing say? What's in there? That's what I was interested in. And that's what attracted me to Dan's TikToks. And that's what attracted me to the work that he's been doing.
Because I think there are people out there who want to know what the data are, rather than just want to have their biases confirmed. A lie can travel around the world before the truth gets its shoes on. That's been my experience on social media in so many ways. And that's what got me interested in trying to dive into the discussion, to share the data to show that on all sides of these discussions, there is misinformation.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about what the Bible actually says today. And we should mention, the podcast isn't focused on the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, though McClellan does point it out when his fellow Latter-day Saints get it wrong. But Dan McClellan and Dan Beecher's relationship with faith is a good place to start. Beecher grew up here in the church. He was all in until the time came when he was supposed to go on a mission.
I spent probably 6 months wrestling with just, okay, God, I just need you to confirm this for me. I started to fast frequently. I started to read scripture frequently. I started to pray earnestly and very dramatically every night. And it became a little too zealous, and it became a little too crazy, and it became overwhelming. If I had owned a whip, I would have been flagellating. It was just too much.
Yeah.
So then I said to God, I basically prayed and said, I still want you to be there. I can't keep this up. So I'm still here. Hit me up. Holler at your boy. But I can't keep doing this. And then it was time for me to really consider going on this mission thing. And I went to my bishop and I just said, I haven't gotten this confirmation yet that I was supposed to have. What am I supposed to do? And he said, well, maybe, you know, let's get you prepared for the temple. And maybe if you go through the temple, you know, as the Mormon temple is a very important, not just rite of passage, but, you know, it's a sacred ceremony that you go through. And I said, yeah, let's do that. I want to feel the spirit. I want to feel this thing. And he sat me down for a bishop's interview, and he had a binder with questions that he opened up and looked down at, and he's, you know, going to ask me all the questions. And he says, do you believe in God, the Eternal Father, and in His Son, Jesus Christ, and in the Holy Ghost? And he stares at me. And I said, that's the problem. I don't know.
Yeah.
We looked at each other, and I said, oh, I have to answer yes, don't I? And he nodded. And I said, well, I can't honestly do that. You know what? The truth is, I think I was supposed to lie. I think the truth of the matter is that I was supposed to just fake it until I made it.
Yeah.
But we shook hands and I walked out and I never walked back in. But it did like open the doors for me to actually ask much bigger questions. I thought I had been asking the big questions, but the questions got much bigger at that point. And eventually I realized, oh, I don't think that this is true. And the more I looked at it, the more that just felt like, yeah, none of this rings real for me.
Yeah. Dan McClellan, let me shift to you. And I'm actually not going to ask you about your faith journey. I'm going to ask you about another part of your life, and that is your sort of professional point of view. You have four degrees, one from Oxford, one from Exeter. You have a bachelor's degree from BYU. And let me focus on that first one, that first degree.
Yeah.
You focused on biblical Hebrew, minored in classical Greek. So just as to give people a sense of where you're coming from, why? Like, what was it that interested you about classical Greek and biblical Hebrew?
This is great. I've wanted to know the story, too.
So it started for me, actually, on my mission. Now, I was an adult convert to the church. I joined the church when I was 20 years old in Plano, Texas.
Wow.
And I had a ton of support from the ward into which I was baptized, the Plano Ninth Ward. And they said, we want you to prepare for a mission. And I said, I could never afford that. And they said, we'll cover the whole thing for you. Just get ready and go. And so I was baptized on September 9th, 2000. On September 10th, 2001, I sent my mission papers in. And September 11th, 2001, the whole world changed. And I was, you know, we didn't know if missions were going to still be a thing. But I got called to go serve as a missionary in the Montevideo, Uruguay mission. So I realized, in that year that I had between getting baptized and leaving on a mission, I realized, oh, I'm going to be way behind everybody else. I've never read the Bible. I had read the Book of Mormon leading up to getting baptized. So I decided I was
going to— You had never read the Bible at that point?
No. I'd read pieces of it here and there, but I had read less than, 0.1% of it.
Yeah. So no deep interest in scripture at that point
No. Yeah, yeah. No. Hmm. And so I decided I needed to get through all of the standard works at least once before I went on my mission. And so I spent that year reading voraciously and got out to the mission and realized not only was I no longer behind, I was ahead of most of the other missionaries there. And I just fell in love with reading the Bible in particular, and the Gospels in particular. I was also given a Bible and a Bible dictionary, both in Spanish, while I was down there. The Bible was a Catholic edition of the Bible, so it had the Apocrypha in it. And I was fascinated by these books as well. I had never even heard of these before. Like 2 Maccabees was this fascinating history of this fascinating period. Mm. And as I got into the Bible dictionary, there was a chart that showed ancient Hebrew script and ancient Greek and then contemporary Latin equivalents. And I was like, if I had a Hebrew text, I could at least convert the letters into their Latin equivalents and I could know how things were pronounced. And I didn't know that that's called transliteration at the time. But yeah. I got a little Hebrew text and I started trying to decipher Hebrew and did an awful job. But the more I studied, the more I loved the languages and the literature and the history. And
you didn't say faith among those three. So it was history, literature, language. How much of your interest in, biblical Hebrew was a mechanism to justify your belief system?
There was no doubt a little bit of it, but I had always been kind of a contrarian. Huh. I was the kid who always asked why and was always like, that didn't make sense to me. The first thing I ever published when I was still an undergrad at BYU, the paper was called Latter-day Saints and Patristics. And basically the paper was, these are things that Latter-day Saints see in patristic authors, early Christian authors, that they think validates their faith and shows that there's a proto-Mormonism in early Christianity. Huh. And the paper went through and said, this is why this doesn't work, this is why this doesn't work, this is why this doesn't work. And so I didn't want to destroy anyone's faith, but I didn't want it to be based on misinformation and on inaccuracies and on just wanting to believe something that the data didn't support. So I have always kind of caused trouble in that regard. I, from the start, was saying I'm going to let the data lead me wherever they may, and I'm going to let them operate on their own terms rather than trying to twist them to serve my interests. And, you know, I wasn't always 100% successful at that, and I'm still – I do my best to root out my biases, but nobody can be totally perfect at that. So people catch me out frequently – not frequently, but
– Did you ever worry in saying that, that you may find something that – was in so much conflict with your new faith of Mormonism that you couldn't do that anymore?
No, I don't think I worried about that too much.
Because you had faith.
I'm sure there were periods where, I was – maybe something was intimidating. But yeah, for me, faith was always something separate from that. It was something that I compartmentalized because faith is not – what you can prove, even according to the way that faithful people like to define faith, according to the book of Hebrews. And so for me, it was no one ever told me, look, you're not allowed to do that. Look, you have to think about it this way. And so everything was already always compartmentalized for me. In fact, I can still recall very vividly walking into the Institute room in the chapel on in Dallas where I took Institute classes before I went on my mission. And there was a big blue sign in the back of the room that said, find out for yourself. And so I always figured, all right, it's up to me. It's my job. It's my prerogative. And so I'm going to find out.
So we're going to jump over a lot of time, space here because I want to get to the podcast, which is years after these things happened. Let's talk a little bit about the idea of the podcast itself. One of the things you've both mentioned is wanting to share this critical academic approach. As you said, Dan Beecher, what is in this thing? Like, let's actually talk about what's actually there, not what people think is there or the interpretation of what they think is there. Is that what you're getting at with the what you were trying to do with the podcast?
Absolutely. I think that's exactly the point, which is, you know, and obviously our title is meant to sort of be a nod to that, data over dogma. What's real? What's actually there? And what's being ignored because it's not convenient or it's not faith promoting? And what's being twisted and what's being – and what misinformation is out there about it that we can dispel?
It's interesting you mention that you compartmentalize the faith part over the data part. And I wonder if it can be said that you can find data to prove what's in the Bible, but you can't actually find data to confirm your belief in God. Like, is there actually data? Is there evidence that fits in the faith part? Or is that something that most people will also have to compartmentalize? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't think that I have seen any such data. I think there's from an epistemological point of view, there are a lot of people who would suggest that the idea of faith, the supernatural, is something that sits outside of what we have access to. And
you think that's right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's when we talk about data a lot of some people get upset with me for this motto, data over dogma. It's more of a shorthand than anything else because they're like, well, data is just raw information. That's not structured. That's not organized. It's not interpreted. And so I'm, you know, imposing interpretive lenses on this stuff when I do it. But I'm trying to keep it at the level of what we can demonstrate, what seems most probable, what seems plausible, and distinguishing that from what is implausible, what is impossible.
Dan Beecher, what's the role you play in the podcast? You've got the Dan McLellan who's got the data, or at least knows the data, which isn't to say you don't, but I mean he has.
No, you should definitely say.
Okay. Well, your role is to sort of not to challenge, because I have to say this is one thing that I sort of thought when I heard about the podcast. Oh, it's a debate between an atheist and a believer. It's not that.
No.
So how do you conceive of the part that you're playing in this?
I'm the dumb guy. No, I.
Do you mean that in the sense that your job is to ask the basic question?
I mean, yeah, kind of. And I don't look. I don't want to imply that I have been obsessively scrolling through all of our comments streams, trying to find out, trying to see what everybody's saying about us. But one comment came up on one of our things that was just like, Dan, you need to – Dan, me, Dan.
Yeah.
We can't say Dan.
No.
It's very tricky.
Yeah.
But Beecher, you need to be the guy who asks the questions for those of us who aren't, you know, up on all this stuff. And that's the role that I have set out for myself. Whether I've been doing a good job of it or not, that's the role that I want, which is to say that when Brother McClellan here is – you know, look, he goes off into a reverie about stuff and – he uses words like Ugaritic and, you know, hermeneutics and just a whole bunch of stuff that it's got, you know, to some extent, especially in his TikTok stuff, he's getting through a lot of information in 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And a lot of us feel a little left behind on some of that stuff. It's fascinating, but it's like also, oh, shoot, now I have homework to do because I have to because I don't understand a bunch of what he just said. So hopefully my job is to say, now wait, slow down a second. What did you mean by that?
Yeah.
You know, when we first imagined the podcast, I imagined that sort of Dan would present information and I would be the guy that sort of interjects. What we found was that it was probably better for me to present, at least for part of it, for me to present a bunch of the information, just present what I read in the book, in the text, and just say, okay, what is this? This is ancient text.
Yeah.
It was not written for us. This world is completely different than the world of the people that were consuming that text at the time that it was written. This world would mean nothing to them. And their world means very little to me. So I need not just a linguistic translation of this thing. I need a cultural translation of this thing. I need a geographical translation of this thing. Me just looking at these words on the page, even if it's the best linguistic translation available, I don't have the background to get most of it. And I think that's what people don't understand about this book. That's what I was so attracted to in Dan's work. Oh, that's why it says these things. Oh, okay. That's why I couldn't understand why I couldn't make Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 work together. They seem to be telling the same story, but they don't.
Yeah.
It starts over. We tell a creation story, and then we go back, start over, and tell a different creation story. What's even happening?
Dan Beecher, he and the biblical scholar / TikToker Dan McClellan host the podcast Data Over Dogma. There's a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, I'm Tim Slover, and I'm one of the producers for Radio West. Now, there's a lot I love about my job, but my favorite part actually comes after Doug Fabrizio's put all that really hard work into the interview. And it's the part where I get to sit down and edit the conversation. You know, there's just a flow to it that I can really sink into. Anyway, really, just thanks for being a part of the Radio West audience.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what is in the Bible, which would seem like a simple question, but it's not. The religion scholar Dan McClellan says people are really invested in that book. We have these social identities all tied up in what a prophet or God may have said. So we pick and choose, which is understandable. But McClellan says you should also know what's actually in the text and where it actually came from. McClellan has teamed up with podcaster Dan Beecher on a new podcast called Data Over Dogma. Dan McClellan, what is the Bible? What was its purpose? Because this is one of the things you mention frequently, actually, that it's more about, if I understand what you're saying, it's more about meaning, extracting meaning and getting something useful than it is truth, maybe. Is that right?
Well, yeah, that opens up a few different points of discussion. So talking about meaning, however, yeah, I think for most people today who approach the Bible as something inspired, as something authoritative, they're going to get the most out of it to the degree that it informs their own experiences, that it informs their own decisions, that it is meaningful, that it is useful to them. And so
– wait. What you're saying is they're going to cherry pick the stuff that actually works with their belief system and their social identity and where they're coming from.
There's a degree of that, but there's also a degree to which this is inevitable because texts don't have inherent meaning. Meaning is generated within the mind of a reader, a hearer, a viewer, if somebody's signing. And so that all is limited by the experiences of that mind. You cannot generate a meaning for something if you have had no experience with that particular meaning or don't have adequate experience to infer that given meaning. And an example I like to use is when I was my first week at Oxford, I was on Corn Market Street, which is this foot traffic retail district. And I was getting phones set up for my wife and me and trying to get my bank account set up. And I saw a KFC and I'm like, jackpot. And I went in and I said, hey, y'all have biscuits? Biscuits in the UK are cookies. And so I was like, oh, of course, I should have known better. And then I realized I had no idea how to explain to this poor young man behind the counter what it was I was looking for. And other people later were like, oh, you should have said a scone. And I was like, that's not a scone. That's not a biscuit. That's not what I'm looking for. And they had absolutely no clue what I was talking about. And I had to go across the street and eat at Burger King. But they didn't have the experience with the language to be able to generate in their own mind this image of what I wanted. And I didn't have the experience to be able to articulate what I wanted in a way that was accessible to them. And the same thing is true of text. Texts mean absolutely nothing without a mind or some kind of program or something that can generate that meaning. And so any reading of the Bible is a negotiation with the text because it is whatever those symbols are on the page versus whatever experience we have had with the language represented on that page. And so it's inevitable that we're negotiating with it. And what's
– well, before we get to the negotiation part because I want to come back to that. But is it history? Is it – genealogy? Like, what is this thing?
Yes, it's all of those things. Yeah. But the Bible didn't exist until around the 4th century CE. So everything before that, you can't really talk about the Bible. You can talk about the texts that were ultimately included in the Bible. Yeah. And so it had no single function. The texts were produced to serve the rhetorical goals of the authors and editors who produced them. And those changed as one editor got a hold of it. And then reappropriated it, reoriented it, recirculated it, changed things a little bit to serve other rhetorical functions. And so some of it is about structuring power in favor of one king over another, or in favor of one region over another, in favor of one priesthood over another. Some of it was about trying to help people rationalize why bad things happen to good people. The wisdom literature, Job and Ecclesiastes and other parts of the Bible are about just grappling with the problem of evil. You have the genealogies, which are intended to kind of establish a genealogical line to say, hey, we are all part of the same family. We need to get along. And so the Bible serves a ton of different functions since it was created. The text of the Bible served a bunch of different functions before it was created. So today, the Bible is whatever someone approaches it for.
Yeah.
Some people approach it to – they want to feel God's presence. Some people want answers to doctrinal questions. Some people want to use it as a bludgeon against other groups and frequently marginalized and minoritized and oppressed groups. Some people read it because their family expects them to. And so they just want to be able to engage in that bit of costly signaling so they can access the resources that their family has available. So tons and tons of different reasons for it. And I get a question a lot, what's the best translation of the Bible? And my response is that depends on what you want to use it for.
Yeah. Dan Beecher, let me ask you, what do non-believers get wrong about the Bible?
I mean, non-believers are just as likely – you know, I've talked about how non-believers will often use the Bible against believers. And, you know, sometimes in their zeal to do that, they will, you know, they'll appropriate a certain story in a way that maybe it wasn't intended to be appropriated.
Yeah.
We haven't actually gotten to this, Dan, but one of your TikToks, you know, there's a lot of atheists like to make arguments, for instance, you know, the Bible doesn't have anything to say whatsoever about abortion. Mm-hmm. However, there are some stories in the Bible that you can extrapolate to be significant in the discussion of abortion. And I said, like, for instance, Dan made a post about,
is it Deuteronomy?
The potion that
Numbers 5.
It's called the
Sotah, the ordeal of the woman suspected of adultery.
I've read it myself, and I've always read it to mean, and this is where Dan and I have not had this discussion yet. So this is we're doing it live, but. I read that as – because what it says, and Dan, you may feel free to correct me on this, is that it says a woman suspected of adultery is brought before a priest. The priest whips up a little potion, grabs some dirt from the floor and whatever, and then she is to drink it. And my understanding of it is that if she drinks it – my understanding is this is a woman who is caught in adultery because she is pregnant. And if she drinks it – and it is her husband's baby, then she will be fine and nothing will happen. If it is not her husband's baby, then the pregnancy will terminate. That's how I understand that story. You seemed, Dan, to have a different understanding of that story.
Yeah. So when you look at the text closely, there are some parts of it that are a little ambiguous and other parts that are not. So if the woman is innocent, it says she will conceive. So this is a future tense. This is the blessing that is given to the woman if it turns out she's innocent, is that she will conceive a child. The punishment, if she is guilty, is a little ambiguous. It talks about her thigh dropping. It talks about her womb doing something, a verb that doesn't occur very much, and we don't know exactly what it means. It can mean distend. It can mean swell. So we have to engage in some judgment calls here. And some people think, oh, that probably is a reference to the womb expelling whatever is inside of it, that it will miscarry. There are other people that say, well, this imagery is also used in other texts to talk about infertility, that basically her nethers are going to become disfigured and inoperative. And so it would be about blessing of fertility versus a curse of infertility. And the early rabbis who were talking about this text actually debated whether or not it would be appropriate to put a woman who was pregnant through this ordeal. So the earliest history of the text does not seem to indicate it was assumed to involve a pregnant woman. I don't see any indication that a fetus is anywhere in view. And my argument is that if the positive outcome is that she will conceive, that would indicate that there was no fetus, at least manifestly, involved. So there's no reason to think that suspicion was aroused because of a pregnancy or something like that. But there is some ambiguity in some of the Hebrew, and that's where it's a little hard to tell.
So this is, you've just witnessed the first data over dogma debate.
There it is.
That's about as close as it's going to come. But then I have to just yield because he obviously knows.
Yeah, you do. That's right.
I don't.
But Dan Beecher, aren't you doing the thing that we're talking about everyone does, which is you take your own ideas about abortion, which there ought to be abortion rights, and there in the Bible you find a scripture in Numbers that suggests some – ancient version of mephipristone or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Are you just sort of doing that?
I am.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I don't think the contention of our show is that either of us are without biases or frameworks or even beliefs or desires for what this thing might mean.
Yeah, you cop to that, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I do think that what's really important to both of us is doing our damnedest not to impose ourselves on the text. We can take the text, and once we've figured out as much as we can what the text was trying to say, how that would have been interpreted by the people of the time, then go nuts. Then take that information and do with it as you please. We will. Dan will. I will. But that's not what the show is about. The show isn't about here's how you should interpret it now. It's just let's get real clear on it. Let's understand it the best we can with the most up-to-date data that we can, with the most clear eyes that we can look at it. And from there, you can go in whatever direction you need to.
It seems to me that what non-believers get wrong about the Bible might be the same as what believers get wrong about the Bible. That non-believers have this presumption of the way the Bible works for believers.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so they therefore have their own take on that. But like one of the things that – which gets to the question of what do believers get wrong about the Bible, and this is one of the things, Dan McClellan, you've talked about. The Bible, that you say, does not speak with a single or consistent voice. This is a presumption that a lot of faith groups believe, that the Bible says one thing. Mm-hmm. It's consistent throughout. Frankly, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints believes this. But you say it's not, and this is the term of art that you use, univocal. Mm-hmm. So say a little bit about that, because this seems like one of the things that I think people do get wrong about the Bible from your point of view.
Yeah, yeah. I would say a lot of people get that wrong, as well as sometimes non-believers who sometimes want to adopt the terms that believers are operating with. And so it's an attempt to kind of beat them at their own game by showing that even if you presuppose the univocality of the Bible, this and that doesn't work. But yeah, in order for the text to be meaningful, to be useful for a lot of folks who believe it is inspired, that means it has to share an origin, it has to share a source, and so it should share a perspective as well. If they recognize that the text can conflict, that they can come from different authors who in some cases are directly contradicting each other. The books of Samuel and Kings, for instance, were taken up by some editors responsible for Chronicles who changed all kinds of things because they wanted it to say something different. James directly contradicts Paul regarding faith and works in James 2. And so if you believe that it is all theopneustos is the Greek word that means God breathed, that a lot of people think means inspired. In other words, it is all God's own thinking, its own God's own breath. Now, it didn't actually mean that originally. It meant life-giving, as in God breathing the breath of life into the human. But if they think that all Scripture is God-breathed, then James and Paul and the editors of Samuel Kings and the editors of Chronicles cannot be disagreeing with each other. They have to agree on this.
Right.
And so there's this presupposition that is imposed on the text, which then requires negotiating with it and saying, well, how can we understand James in a way that aligns with Paul? There's always going to be a text that is centered and prioritized, and then other texts that have to be reinterpreted to agree with the prioritized text. And so James is reinterpreted to agree with Paul. And, it's largely on a case-by-case basis. A lot of times within particular arguments, people are going to take a stance on a given text that they are not going to take within a separate argument.
Yeah.
And that kind of betrays the negotiation that's going on there. But there are no data that support the idea that the text all speaks with the same unified, consistent voice or from the same perspective. And when we impose that presupposition, it also silences the voices that are in the text, the authors who are trying to achieve something. We're telling them, no, you're not allowed to say that. You have to – whatever you say must contribute to the presupposition that we're imposing on the text. And these days, this primarily has to do with defending one's identity, one's social identity, one's reading of the text, which means in a very real sense, we are telling the Bible what it is and is not allowed to say. So – the text itself has no authority. The authority derives from the agreements that people arrive at regarding what the text is allowed to say. And so I have a real problem with people who try to wield the text authoritatively on a public level or even within debates on social media.
Yeah. It must, though, show you how high the stakes are for people to believe certain things.
Oh, it's life and death in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think that you use the word negotiating a lot. Let's negotiate with the text. Well, no, not just today. I mean, throughout your work. This seems like an important idea for you, and I wanted
– I have a literary agent who is like, you should find a better word.
Is that right?
Well, at least a different word if you're writing a trade book.
Yeah, so. Yeah, right. Well, but let's use the word, and I want to hear you both on this. Because the question is, like, how should people then – what you're saying is they should – same what Dan Beecher, you just said, cop to your biases. Just acknowledge that this is where you're coming from. And acknowledge also that the Bible is a negotiation. It's a product of that negotiation. Because one of the things you've said, Dan McClellan, is that it's really only a problem when people just deny the fact that it's a product of negotiation, that they say, no, there's one truth. There's, you know, one God, one idea of God, you know, one concept here, when in fact it's not that. And it's not like you both are proselytizing a way to use the Bible, but that does seem like important to you. If everyone would just understand, look, you got to negotiate with this text because it's all over the map. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
I think so. Yeah, it is all over the map. If we want to isolate texts and say this is what they're doing and this supports what's going on over here, great. But I think people, if they thought a little more critically about why they're using the text the way they are, I mean, I tell people within my own faith community, believers who approach me and ask, how can I get this out of the Bible? I say, know what you want to get out of the Bible, and that'll help you bring the tools and the frameworks and the approaches to the text in order to maximize the success of that rhetorical goal. And a lot of times when people who want to use it to structure power are the ones who are going to try to mask that as much as possible, because in order to wield it as an authority, that authority has to extend beyond their own negotiation with the text. Yeah. They have to be able to assert the authority of their reading over other people. And that's when you run into problems. But if you can cop to the fact that we are negotiating with the text, and you can say, here is why I'm approaching the text in this particular moment. I want to get this out of it. I'm going to bring these tools to it. Hopefully you get what you are looking for out of it. And I don't see any reason why there's anything problematic about that. I don't remember the exact quote. I think, Harold Bloom, somebody said something about reading. The point of reading is to learn about ourselves. And
that sounds like something Harold Bloom would say, actually.
It is wildly simplified. Yeah. Like, that is don't let the pigeon drive the bus level approach to what he said. But The Bible is about creating meaning, not about finding meaning. Yeah. And if people can come together and create meaning for their community in a way that's not doing harm to other people, that isn't trying to leverage power or anything like that, I think that's perfectly fine. And we have examples of that. People who have approached the Bible from a liberation perspective, liberation theology, has helped an awful lot of people. Womanist approaches to the Bible. There's some wonderful scholars out there working on womanist approaches, feminist approaches, queer approaches to the Bible, bring so much more meaning to the text for the kinds of people who would be victims of the text in most other contexts. And so I think there are valuable ways to approach the text, and there are harmful ways to approach the text. And I would like people to be more – to think more critically about why they're approaching the text, and hopefully be able to see through some of the more harmful reasons and set those aside.
It's Dan McClellan, along with Dan Beecher. They host the podcast Data Over Dogma. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Being a dependable, trustworthy news source, that's our goal at KUER. In order to meet that goal, we depend on listener contributions. Your support ensures the local and national news heard on KUER remains independent, commercial-free, and accessible for all. If you rely on our programming to stay informed, become our newest sustainer with a gift of just $5 a month. Start your monthly support at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West and Beck Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Dan Beecher and Dan McClellan. They have a new podcast called Dogma Over Data. We're talking about what the Bible really says. There's this episode 2 of the podcast I was listening to. And you have this conversation with this seems like a terrific religion scholar. She was your on your dissertation committee, I guess.
She was my supervisor, yeah.
Great, by the way. And say her name, by the way.
Francesca Stavrakopoulou.
Yeah, she was great. And one of the things that comes up in the conversation is that there is a difference between being a religion scholar and a theologian. Mm-hmm. Don't call a religion scholar a theologian. They hate that. But I wanted to ask you, Dan McClellan, how do you, as a religion scholar, but also as a believer, engage with theological ideas? Do you decide, I'm not going to do this professionally? I'll work this out with my wife. I'll talk about it at Sunday school, you know, whatever. But I'm compartmentalizing here. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I do. There are times when I am approaching the text from a more devotional point of view in my private life.
Yeah.
And I have different tools that I bring to it and different ways I think about it.
But don't expect you to do that on your YouTube channel. Google, right?
No. Yeah, no. My social media stuff is strictly academic. But at the same time, yeah, as a scholar of the Bible, I'm really the closest analogy is because people call me a theologian all the time, and most people don't mean it. You know, it's harmless. They're not trying to be accusatory or anything like that. But that would be like calling someone who studies surgery a surgeon. I'm not engaged in the practice of it. I'm engaged in the study of it. I'm on the outside looking in saying, this is why they're doing that. Okay, historically people have done that, and then we got this other technology, or they learned this other thing, or they needed to change this. And so I'm on the outside engaged in the study of it, not in the practice of it. And that's the biggest difference. And so sometimes people wield that title theologian as a weapon against me. I'm not offended by it. But it's not what I do, and I think a theologian brings different tools to the discussion entirely. And there are times when I operate, like I said, privately as a theologian. And I was the gospel doctrine teacher in my ward for most of last year when we were covering the Old Testament. And so when I stood up in that class, I was engaged in the practice of theology to some degree. Now, I was also leveraging a lot of the scholarship to try to make that theology a little more productive, a little more meaningful. I wanted those people to hear something they haven't heard a billion times before. Which is one of the things that makes gospel doctrine so boring for a lot of people. those are two different approaches with two different sets of tools and methodologies and assumptions as well. And yeah, for me at least, never the twain shall meet on at least in the social media stuff that I do.
How is the God you understand, have come to understand as a religion scholar, different from the God of the guy in your Sunday school class who's a software engineer?
It is informed by a much better understanding of the point of these representations within an ancient rhetorical context. So when I talk about the God that is being represented in the book of Deuteronomy, I'm talking about a God who a specific king has structured in order to serve this campaign of cultic centralization where we're not going to allow people to worship in all these other cult sites and temples. They all need to come down to Jerusalem to worship in my temple. And I've also seen artistic depictions of this deity with their wife, from around 800 BCE and have stood in the Judahite temples in Arad where this deity was worshipped outside of Jerusalem. And so there's a lot more of that ancient context that is coming into the images that are being conjured up in my head when I talk about this deity. And in a lot of ways, it's a very foreign, alien deity to me. It's not what brings meaning to me. But I think that's one of the reasons that's one of the things I value is that I am not trying to make this deity more meaningful to me or more useful to me. I'm trying to reconstruct the deity as it would have been meaningful or useful to them anciently. And for most people today, that's not going to have a lot of meaning or utility, but that's going to be more accurate.
But don't you empathize with the fact that most people can't relate to a deity that was worshipped or conceived of, 5,000 years ago, that they need to relate to something that's more personal, that seems more modern even.
Yeah. And I think one thing that I try to do is point out that, that's something that hopefully everybody can understand, that we want something that's we're going to be able to relate to, that is going to be meaningful to us. And this actually comes up in discussions of Jesus as a white man. I bring this up, you go to Asia, Jesus is Asian in a lot of depictions. You go to Africa, Jesus is African. And so I can understand why in the Byzantine Empire, Jesus begins to be depicted in a more lighter-skinned way. Now, this gets taken up and gets deployed for explicitly white supremacist purposes to leverage this Jesus to subordinate other peoples. Our Jesus looks like us, so you are less than, you are other, and therefore we have a right to take your land, take your stuff, take your women and take your bodies and do what we want with them. And so it gets deployed for horrific purposes. But I think hopefully people can understand that's kind of a natural thing to happen. And so when I talk to people who want to view God a certain way, you know, that's perfectly natural. That's what makes it meaningful and useful for them. But I want them to understand as well, if you want to understand the person who wrote the book of Isaiah or the book of Deuteronomy or Exodus, you got to step outside that desire and understand that they wanted their deity to resonate with them, to identify with them. And so are we telling them, no, it, you know, this is my deity, I don't care what you have to say about it, or are we going to let it operate on their terms? And it's difficult. And that's one of the reasons I was worried that my social media content and even the podcast would not be very popular, because we were basically going to make it unrelatable. We were going to make it uninteresting. We were going to make it we were going to basically—
All that boring data.
Yeah. We were going to de-operationalize so much, something that some people have been like, this is so meaningful to me. I can use this in all these arguments. And I'm like, it doesn't work that way. And then, you know, everything falls to the floor. I was afraid that people would be like, not for us. But
people haven't been that way.
They have not.
So that must be— encouraging, right? That people are maybe looking for this, some people anyway, are looking for the same kinds of things out of this conversation about the Bible.
I think that, look, whether you're a believer or you're not, you have to acknowledge, like, the Bible is the most influential book ever. And we're all going to bump up against it. And I think there's something genuinely relieving. There is a breath of fresh air when someone just approaches it with as little agenda as possible, just honesty about what we can know is in it. I think that there's something so freeing about that approach. It's what attracted me to Dan's work. It's what made me, as an atheist, want to do a podcast about the Bible, which a lot of people, I got to say, I raised an eyebrow or two when I made this announcement. But it's because it is an influential book. It is a powerful book. And I think a lot of us are very used to approaches that don't feel honest.
Dan Beecher. He and the biblical scholar slash TikToker Dan McClellan host the podcast Data Over Dogma. There's a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Our producers are Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.